Vibe tribes. Welcome back, people, to another episode of Vibes and Tribes with me, your host, Bio, Baze, B Diddy, whatever you want to call me. We here. And we've got another juicy episode for you, people. Today I am joined by good friend and former colleague, Tim. So, Tim, I don't know if you want to quickly introduce yourself, your current role, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah, perfect. So, Tim Hudson, firstly, thanks for having me on. Currently senior manager of analytics implementation at YOOX Net-a-Porter, and a consultant at Higher Oak Consulting.
Oh, okay. Net-a-Porter.
Apparently.
I've been saying it wrong this whole time.
Well, it's Net-a-Porter and then Mr. Porter. So
that's really, really strange. Okay, before we take it back, guys, to those listeners new and old, please make sure to like, subscribe, comment, interact, share, because you know we're trying to do a big thing here, at Vibes and Tribes _. So with that, let's take it way, 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 way back as we do. Tim, talk to me about secondary school. What was your experience like? Where did you go to secondary school?
So I went to Selsdon High School in Croydon. Which
South London. Sorry,
there's a lot of pride in that.
Yeah,
which is now an academy. I think it's called something else now. But yeah, Selsdon High School, and yeah, it was almost a bit in two parts. Really. Okay. So I think even going back to primary school, I'd like to think quite a bright child, quite enjoyed school, quite driven by parents to do well. And my older brother was quite smart as well. So there's always that yardstick of your parents always pushing you, and even teachers doing that as well.
Yeah.
Did kind of SATs a year early, always top set, etc.
You did SATs a year early?
Yes.
Oh, bloody hell. That's the first of this pod, fair.
And in that sort of carried on in secondary school, and back end of year 8, so kind of 12, nearly 13, my father passed away and just completely gave up. Just didn't interest. There was no, I think potentially because the drive wasn't there coming from him, but I saw no value in school. I saw I think like a lot of people on this before have said they enjoyed the social part of school, right? That was a good bit for them, and that's what it became for me, and it became very much missing lessons, losing all interest.
Okay.
It's definitely a period I look back on and go, I probably should have done a lot more then.
Yeah. So question from me. So obviously it sounds like things were going well until year 8 and then they've taken a turn. Mm-hmm. Did you kind of have an idea and direction that you wanted to head in before that happened? And then, like you said, did that change as a result?
I think my interest has always been in tech. That was even from the age of kind of 5 or 6. We had a Windows 95 PC from our old school, and that was... those are our games. You know, we didn't have consoles, or kind of we'd have, you know, a level behind everyone else. So the interest was always tech. I think as soon as I started to lose interest in school, I think like a lot of people, I thought I'd be a footballer at that point. I remember my mum being pulled into the school and having a very frank chat with a teacher and myself. And I remember saying, "It's fine, I'm going to be a footballer."
Oh, wow.
despite being... a very short and malnourished child. I had this dream. But then, yeah, I just sort of, it probably wasn't until right at the end of school that it suddenly dawned on me that there's a life to do. You know, I've got to do something here. And it was between that and PE, the sports side there. And thankfully, with kind of how everything's gone from there, I chose the IT route. But that was always the thing I liked, and I am even to this day I feel very lucky that I get to do something that interests me, right? Regardless of where it is in the field, it's something I've enjoyed doing since I was very young. And from a school perspective, it never really changed. That was always the one subject I liked. At a GCSE level, it was about picking either based on the teacher or just the subject that you found interesting, like PE or like a history. But yeah, never really wavered from, okay, I quite like IT, I spend a lot of time on the computer, and I'm quite good at it, so I will try and follow that route. But with the way school obviously went, there was no good colleges to go to, there was no A-levels to head towards, so it was, I got very, very fortunate because I left with, this is a sentence I can't believe I say, I left with four GCSEs.
Oh, wow.
Which I remember opening the letter and suddenly it was just, okay, that's not
good. It hit home. Yeah.
And I was incredibly fortunate to be, because I think normally when you, so I went to Croydon College to then do BTEC in IT, same course, in fact, that my brother had done. Mm-hmm. And I think with the qualifications I had, I should have had to do a foundation year or something, or it should have been a 3 or 4 year college course. And I think because my IT GCSE was good or because of my brother, I don't know.
Or they gave you back the year for doing SATs early.
Yeah, yes. I'm caught up now. So I was put on the sort of standard 2 year, year BTEC. And from there, it was a case of, okay, now I need to try and knuckle down a bit and sort this out. But yeah, I got very, very fortunate.
Okay.
There was a lot of friends who, in the group I had at the time, that just finished school and didn't go to college, did nothing. And I think I could have very easily ended up on that path.
And was there anything in particular that, I suppose, you know, seeing the four GCSEs, what was it that made you think, you know what, I need to get my act together here and actually make something of myself?
I didn't know the world. We'd grown up in council flats, so neither of my parents worked. There was never an understanding almost of the real world.
It
was never a case of you get to 16, 18, 21, whatever the age, and you work for a living. You have to earn money to pay rent or a mortgage. And no one in our house knew that. So no one was educated on that. So it wasn't until I sort of hit 16, end of school, thought, okay, I'll leave home, I'll go, live somewhere, and it hits you that the world's quite an expensive place. And I even went to a couple of graduate job interviews.
Oh, wow.
Out of sheer optimism, and it really hit home of, okay, there's almost two levels of education I need to do here before I'm ready for that. It was trying to go out and do something very quickly brought it home of, you need to sort this out and actually have formal qualifications, go and learn, and then you'll be actually ready, because you are not ready for the real world at all.
Okay, that's a good insight. you think you're ready until it slaps you in the face. Okay, you do your 2 years at college, you get your BTEC qualification, and what's the thought once you've got this qualification? You've mentioned two levels there. Is it university for you? Is it straight into the working world? What do you decide on?
It was university for me, and again, so my brother didn't go to university, neither the parents did, so didn't really have an idea that even was a pathway. And a friend of mine that I made at college, I'm still very good friends with to this day, he's 2 years older than me. So all of his friends had gone to university. He joined their freshers and gone to visit them in multiple places around the country. And he said, I'm in the process of applying for university, and then kind of educated me on what that was, really. Because as far as I knew, it was just something for very smart and very rich people to do. So I had no idea. And at that point, it was both, I think from a career perspective, this would be really good to go and do. Go and spend 3 years just doing computing, just doing something you really love. And also the opportunity to leave home,
as
well, I think was very big for me of, again, that whole go and see what the real world's like, right? Get out of this
bubble.
five-mile bubble that you've been in for the last 18 years and almost go and be you, right? Get out, get to know people, go and see another city, even other cultures, because the area in Croydon we were in was very not the most
diverse.
And
we know what that means. No, that's fine. So you get to university, where do you decide to go then?
So I went to Leeds Metropolitan University.
Okay.
I think it's called Leeds Beckett now.
Okay.
And that was, again, when choosing, it was not having A levels, the choice was quite limited. The university ranking often had three numbers in it in the table. Yeah. And so obviously the choice was quite limited for computing anyway. And there were quite a few of those in London. I decided very early that
you didn't want to be in London.
I need to go.
And
I am a Leeds United supporter. I'd been up there quite a lot as a child and then a teenager, and I'd grown to quite like the city.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably the third or fourth best in the placings that I could go to. Okay. So that was my first choice. Because of the subpar school performance, I had to retake English in college as well.
Oh wow.
To qualify for, so when everyone got results day from the BTEC, I had to wait even more to get
sure
the English result
English
back.
Yeah.
Which is a harrowing story to tell back now, but it is very much one that there are bits that I do wish I'd paid more attention and learned more, absolutely. But at the same time,
you've been able to recover it.
Yeah, and your path is your path.
Exactly.
And that's it's not about what's happened, it's about learning from it and seeing where it takes you.
It's not about the destination, it's about the journey.
Exactly.
So with that, how was your 3 years at Leeds? Are you focused on the academics or are you focused on everything, the whole experience? Yeah, just give me your top level thoughts on.
I think a bit of everything. Mm. It was there were parts of the degree that I loved, absolutely loved doing, the opportunity to arguably for the first time in my life to sit and study, to learn properly, because even in school I was very much tried to be a bit of a joker,
yeah,
mess around. Still in the office sometimes can be that way, and yeah, it was the first time that I could sit around and just do something I enjoy. But yeah, it was a bit of everything. It was, yeah, obviously because I'm the end of the school year as well, so I'd turned 18 maybe 2 months before going to university.
Yeah.
So everyone's had a whole
year,
6-9 months. It was all very new to me, and that side was good. And even just on the social aspect of having to make friends, was particularly in an estate, you just, any kid within the 4 years of you automatically friends. You'll be outside, you'll play, and that's just how it is. And having to do that, having to live with strangers, having to go and experience the world was huge. And then the academic side, I liked most of it. I think the problem with, I think this is really coming to a head now with the speed of technology, is a degree like computing where
the syllabus doesn't keep up
exactly
with how quickly
everything's
advancing. Like, you're working on Windows 95, but by the time you come out, it's MacBook Pro.
Exactly. Yes.
And that and the other.
Yeah. We were building one of the courses in second year, and this was, the iPhone had been out for a while at this point, and we were building games in Java ME, which was basically what was used for Snake on the 3310.
Oh, wow.
That's how back days this was. And so, for the most part, it was,
it didn't evolve with the times.
But yeah, there were a bit too many parts of that that were, why are we doing this? And I think a bit too, I think anyone that does computing says they learn so much more in the first month
of work
than
so with that in mind, do you think your degree helped you in your working life?
Yes, in that, unfortunately, I think a lot of, at the time, it's definitely changed now, but at the time there was almost every role
required it.
Is either a graduate scheme or you must have a degree. And I had a friend from college who dropped out the first year of university and just nobody would touch them.
Like, really?
All, yeah, they ended up going back because they just could not.
Get
even entry-level roles.
Wow.
Yeah, and they self-taught programming, all of this, but
wasn't enough.
Yeah,
so the degree really carries weight in computing.
It did at the time.
It did at the time.
Much less so now.
So my question with that, so you did 3 years. You said there were some bits you really enjoyed, some bits not so much. Did it help you formulate, I suppose, where you wanted to, like, the field you wanted to go specialize in with regards to computing?
Yeah, and it's, which is tricky because it's a very, very wide field and a wide course. You're going all the way from the security endpoint of ethical hacking and all this back to the very basic research OS level, which is great, but it doesn't whittle down quick enough. I think you choose your I think 6 modules for the final year. But you arguably actually come a year earlier. I think it should get more and more advanced. So, But yeah, I decided very early that I loved the web side of it. So I think even from a young age, I'd been coding, building websites. I'd done kind of bits on the side, building websites for friends, doing kind of media. So that was very...
Can you still build websites?
I can, yes. Yeah,
asking for a friend.
Yes, I still get... even my mother-in-law asked not long ago to do one for her. So
okay, nice.
It still comes in handy.
Okay, nice. Yeah. And I suppose just jumping ahead a bit, how, you know, we've spoken about how technology advances. How do you keep on top of the times and how do you make sure that your skills continue to be up to date?
I think you have to use what's out there, whether that's... And some people aren't big fans of going off, but whether that's social media, whether that's tailoring it to your needs, whether that's news, whether that's just courses, right? Just hitting a site like Udemy, the first page, looking at a particular category.
What's Udemy, sorry?
So Udemy is a video tutorial website.
Okay.
Mainly specializing in tech,
okay.
But covers all sorts. And it's very... all the courses are... they're very, very free. But they're normally, you're talking good sort of 50 modules or very large courses that are always priced at £200-£250, but they're always on sale at £10. always the way. So that's a very good one to...
Nothing
to,
like a 95% discount. I love that.
So that's going to use... I think YouTube is great. I think as soon as you hear... something relevant, you overhear someone doing something at work, you can just quickly take half an hour, small bit of research. And often it can be, that's good to know, but it's not that relevant to what I'm doing, because there's arguably even a difference between, so we're analytics implementation and then pure analytics. Even in that field, there's a big difference in the skills you need. So it's about looking at where you are and where you want to be as well, because even people in my team now, we talk about, okay, where are you going, right? What's the future? And therefore go and learn a skill that might not be relevant to you now, but if you want to be a data scientist or a full stack developer, you need to start doing these bits now. So I think it's often giving to is look at job specs as well. And I say this to people I manage when they're trying to work out where they want to go, not because you want them to apply for jobs, obviously, but go and look at roles that are around your field, what interests you and what they ask for. Because if you start seeing, particularly in web development, the last year, 2 years, React has been a big thing. In data, Python's a big one. And the more you start seeing that, the more important it is, and therefore start learning.
So, you know, I'm happy to talk about current. As you manage people, do you task them with learning about these things as you learn about them? Like, oh, I read something on React. Oh, this might be good for you to read up on Python. Like, or is it just one of those things you're hoping that it comes from within people who work under you?
It's always better when it comes from them, definitely, because that shows a level of drive and maturity to go and figure that out for yourself. Sometimes people need the push, absolutely. And sometimes people don't know as well. They don't know.
You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then I've got another question. Sorry. We've jumped and we'll go back, but I've just got some really juicy questions. So knowing how you performed in school, where you've come from and where you're at now, does that inform your management style? And how do you deal with underperforming employees? Sorry, that's really loaded. I don't know how much you can say.
I think it's definitely, especially for managing people very early in their career. I think it definitely drives a bit of, look, you know, just if you can just iron out these one or two things, you can go far. You know, it's sometimes it's the tech side, sometimes it's soft skills, which I think particularly at a young age can be really underappreciated.
What's a soft skill? Like communication?
So, yeah. So if you're working with stakeholders, sometimes just the ability to write a coherent email is so undervalued, because you go, well, but I've written this incredible program that does this. Yeah. Why does it matter?
Yeah.
And the higher up you get in roles and the more you'll never work solely on your own. It's it's just not the way. And having skills like that, yeah, people don't realize how important those are. And especially as you, even just from a natural progression of, you know, engineer to senior engineer, almost always that seniority doesn't just come because you're good. Mm-hmm. It's often you need to take a junior under your wing, or you need to now communicate more, or project plan more, and and those are the things that I definitely didn't appreciate that I needed, and therefore arguably potentially held me back, or came from going all the way back to the lack of education and kind of caring at that point. And I think when dealing with underperforming, it definitely comes in because I look back to I'm sure we'll get onto it, the first couple of jobs I had, and even when you and I were working together, I'd yet to reach that point of maturity where I understood how to work properly.
Really?
Definitely, yeah.
Oh my God. I thought you were a superstar, can I just say. I'm not even just saying that. Like, we can get onto like that work now, but when I saw you, maybe you weren't doing anything, but you were regularly one of the first people in the office. You were regularly one of the last people out of the office. And just, you know, you talk about those soft skills in terms of genuinely wanting to help people. Like, we always wanted you on calls because you always seem to be one of the most knowledgeable, and I think it marries up with what you're saying now. So for you to think that even at that stage of your career you weren't maybe where you should have been, maybe that just speaks volumes of yourself and the expectations you have for yourself, and explains how you've been able to get where you are. So I suppose with that, what was your first role out of university?
So the first role I had was at a sports coaching startup.
Okay.
Which, if going back to the two subjects at school that I liked, is the dream first role. So it was, so I'd been really almost accidentally switched on during university, and that I worked during that, and not and there's obviously nothing wrong with it, but not bar jobs, but very specific roles. So before going to uni, in fact, I'd done a lot at the local football club in terms of filming games and doing kind of media and match reports and all those things. And through a connection of that, I landed a summer job at the end of first year. Then through a university program, I landed a job in the summer second year that carried on all the way through final year.
Nice.
So, and it's a big thing that whenever I've kind of spoken to people at university, is very much when you do graduate, yes, you have that piece of paper, but so does everyone else. Like, you have to have, especially in tech, you've got to show something else, even if that is just free websites you've built for a mate.
Yeah,
just have that something. And I had that, and that definitely helped land this. I can't remember the title now, but it was a bit of everything. It was a little bit of website editing, a bit of marketing, a bit of social media, all mixed in.
So sorry to jump in, but I just have to ask. So for you, you know, looking at entry-level employees, I know you said it's changed now, but if you just see computer science degree, no extracurriculars, is that a CV straight in the bin because everybody has one and you're looking for people with extracurriculars, or no?
Potentially, yeah. Yeah, we even go back to Deswell days, we had a graduate role and someone hadn't been to uni but had 3 years of tech support experience, and you go, that's so much more of a plus than
just a university, you don't cut your teeth on anything.
Yeah, and you've never had to, okay, maybe you've done some presentations or something, but you've never spoken to clients, you've never sent professional emails. You know, when my wife was in academia, some of the emails she'd show me from students who would just, you know, dear miss, or like, you know, no punctuation, no formalities or anything. And it's not necessarily straight in the middle, but yeah, you're looking for something else.
Yeah.
And especially with some of the CVs we've seen over the last few years of when you're looking at app roles and they've done, you know, one module of the app at university versus someone who's built free themselves from scratch, there's a big difference between those people there.
So question, sorry, I know you've spoken about the role, but as a computer scientist, when you're looking to go into work, what is it you're trying to do? Build a website, build an app, I don't know, code something specific, tech support? Like, how, what was your thought process, or did you enjoy it all?
For me, it was kind of that. It was anything. Just get a job. Get a job and come back to London.
Initially, fair.
But yeah, you do. Back then, anyway, and my friends were the same. Of just you fling out CVs for anything, and then you hope that it. I guess you hope that you can whittle it down, but also you get whittled down as well.
In that
those that you are going to be a bit of a time waster for, you get rejected from anyway, and gradually you form this picture of what it is you want to do. And but yeah, from computer science, you typically pick, you should know in that third year what your skill set is, or at least what your enjoyment is. And that could be front end, back end, it could be databases, it could be something entirely different, it can be apps. And then from there, it's tricky because the job titles are so, potentially if you're coming out of a degree and you hear the term full stack developer, you might have no idea what that means. To you, that could mean you know absolutely everything, but that's not what they're after. Just after a bit of everything,
okay.
And you gradually learn all of that.
Okay.
So yeah, you normally pick a speciality and one or two. If it's a coding perspective, it'd be one or two languages as well.
For the listeners, front end development is stuff that actually shows on the website. Back-end development is the stuff behind the scenes that keeps the website up and running and smooth. And then what was the other one you mentioned?
So full stack is both.
Full stack is a bit of both.
Things, yeah. You have database-specific roles, so that's almost even behind the back-end.
We've got there. The back of the back.
Exactly, yeah. And then all of that again as well, websites and apps are built. Well, they're gradually becoming built in the same way, but typically they're also built in entirely different languages as well.
Can I ask a really blunt question? Mm-hmm. For me, when I hear computer science, I think you need to be a genius or like, you know, on the spectrum in order to code. And, you know, you imagine people that you see in films like typing.
Mr. Robot.
Exactly. Mr. Robot. Like, is that the reality? And I suppose, can anyone learn it? Or do you have to have a knack in order to be good at it?
Certain bits require maths.
Damn.
But for the most part, anyone. It's almost just pure, it's logic. It just comes down to logic is what it is. In that some bits you just have to memorize and understand how they work. But once... I think once you've done it for arguably maybe 10, 15 hours, you can really understand the basic bits and then go from there.
You have a solid base.
Yeah.
And then you
can
just like learn and iterate on top of it.
Definitely.
10 to 15 hours.
I think, I'd say so. Yeah. To get an understanding. Cause I think a lot of people, it's just getting past that first hurdle of, okay, what is code? Exactly. Yeah. And as soon as you've got past that and you go, right, okay, so that does that, and it clicks very quickly. In that anyone I've worked with or taught how to do it, it comes in, and then yes, it takes hours upon hours to build on that and get to a point of yes, being good at it. But I think the foundations can come very, very quickly.
And is the foundation different for back end versus front end, or can you learn a basis that encapsulates both? And then kind of go wherever your passion takes you.
Yeah, so you're typically, yes, they're all very, very similar frameworks. Might get some hate for saying that. but for the most part, yes. If you've learned a front-end language, you more than likely know how to learn a back-end one. It's just you've chosen different specialities. So, yes, normally, I think once you've got foundations of one and then you've got to a bit of a... bit closer to intermediate, then I think you can start a second. I don't think it's very much take one and do building blocks, take another.
I think it
is
focus.
Yeah.
And then go. What would you say is harder, front end or back end?
Probably back end. Yeah. Definitely back end.
Definitely back
end. Front end can be annoying.
Front end developers are lazy, back end developers. that's what I've just heard. I'm joking. Please don't kill me.
You're not far.
Oh my god, the tech community, they're gonna come at me and lynch me. All right, let's bring this back. So, okay, your first job, you'd mixed football and tech. Mm-hmm. You said you were doing video in and stuff like that. How long did you do it for?
So I was there for a year.
Okay.
And it was down in Hayward's Heath. Mm-hmm. So I was commuting out of London, and obviously everyone was kind of going the other way, in a sort of sleepy commuter town, and this little office above a bank. And but it was great. There was four of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, four of us, and we shared the office with kind of a sister company. And there was a pool table, dartboard. It was, as a 21-year-old who drank three cans of Dr. Pepper a day, it was the dream. You know, mm-hmm. I'd go to work, you know, involved in sports, get to write code, do that. It was really good, mm-hmm. but it was... I think after a while I realised that was probably all it was ever going to be.
Yeah.
In that there were four of us. If I was going to move up, I'd need one of them to leave.
Yeah.
And they'd all been there sort of 5-6 years.
So the penny dropped in, you had to keep it moving.
Yeah, and I didn't want to at all. I absolutely loved it then. And the three people I worked with were absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
But it was very much, yeah, if this would be good were I... maybe at the time of family or beyond, mm. right? If I wanted something comfortable, this would be great.
And was it like an entry-level salary?
Yes, so, very much so.
So
yeah.
Were you, I mean, you were only there a year, but mm-hmm. did you see a pathway to earning more money?
Not really. So I got a pay rise, I think, the week I ended up handing my notice, fact,
oh my
which
God.
Is quite an awkward conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, only, you know, real kind of increments is all I ever really saw that becoming.
Mm.
But again, you know, I'd it was the first from kind of where we'd come from. I remember telling my mum how much I earned, and she couldn't believe that amount of money. And it was £18,000 a year,
mm.
and I know her head was kind of exploded of that amount, which was rather funny to look.
And 12,000 of that went on travel to Hayward's Heath.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you did that. Where to next?
So then I went. So I actually went from there back to the football club that I'd done some stuff for before,
nice.
Because I kind of drank the Kool-Aid a bit, I think, there. Mm. Of it was a pay rise. They'd just been taken over. So, mm. so I still went to games most Saturday, even while working at the other role. They'd just been taken over. It was a chance to do. The football side full time to do social media. I was still building websites and platforms for the football club.
Yeah,
and they were throwing money on the pitch. It was obvious they were going to challenge for the league, and I kind of just told myself I couldn't not be part of that.
Yeah,
and then in retrospect, it was a very bad career move. And I remember I was sold the dream of it's you can do all the football side, all the reporting, the media, all of that. And on day one, I got pulled aside, and someone said, "Right, these are the functions we've got going on in the bar this week. Can you make sure everything's prepped for those?"
Wow!
And the penny very much dropped of this. I didn't sign up for this at all.
Mm.
And frankly, gradually it moved away from that. But within maybe a month, I was even thinking about applying for my old job back.
Wow.
Back at the old place. Then. And it was all a bit, it wasn't very well organized. It was, just a bit kind of salary coming late, and it was
one of those.
It was a real wake up call, I think, again, that okay, no, this is not right. This isn't how it should be. I've, as much as it was fun in the last place, it was at least professional. Mm. So I know what I want. I want security. I want to know what I'm doing. As so well.
How long before how long did you stick it out?
4.5 months.
Okay, mate, that's a long time.
Yeah,
that's a long time.
Yeah, but I started looking maybe 3 months in, if not even slightly earlier.
And so. for specific roles, or still like quite generic?
For me, it was just anything back in tech.
Okay.
So entry level developer. Typically, you can graduate roles if you're still a year out. You can still get those. Started using LinkedIn a bit more, a bit more, posting more professionally, and started building a portfolio, which I'd kind of stopped doing as soon as I got that first job. Whereas, you know, you need to keep yourself fresh, keep content getting
out. So portfolio
out.
For you is quite
I think at that point, yeah, definitely. I even to this day still have it, and I'll add this to it. Sure. And,
nice.
Yeah, I've always found it. I think back then, definitely, because nowadays there's GitHub, which is where you can basically keep any code you write. You can upload it there and store it. Okay. So that's just a portfolio.
So it's like a Wikipedia there. For code.
Kind of, yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. And it's all code you've written. So
Come and just stare at it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. So often you can, a lot of tech jobs have tests normally. Mm-hmm. Some of them are mad in that you'll sit in a room and two guys will just watch you code for 3 hours.
That's so weird.
But you almost don't need that because you've got this portfolio.
Sorry, I'm going to jump in there again because, you know, talking about coding, one thing I wanted to ask earlier, but I'll do it now. Going back to the Mr. Robot example,
yep.
Coding away, writing lots of code. I work 8, 9, 10 hour days, but even me, like, you need a break, right? You take half hour for lunch,
yeah.
You know, you might have a coffee. When you're in the office, you're talking to people. For a coder, like, how long can you consistently code for? And, like, do you just aimlessly code and make mistakes because you get comfortable? Like, what is that process of coding like? Because it seems so daunting to somebody who's not in computer science. So
yeah.
Maybe, like, help us to understand.
I think, so you start, again, when you start small, that daunting kind of stops. But it's a fun process to get lost in, right?
Okay.
Particularly if it's something you enjoy, it's almost, this is going to sound very
romanticized.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, but I guess almost similar to someone painting, right?
Yeah.
Or even running. Yeah, you can very easily get lost on a run, right? Mm-hmm. Mentally, you forget about everything else and just sort of zone out. And that becomes quite easy to do. And I think that's why a lot of people have music to kind of flush out everything around them and just focus on what's going.
Are you actually writing the code line by line, or is there a lot of copy and paste?
It's a mix of the two. So what you'll often do, a very good way of doing it is to have anything you'll reuse more than once, you kind of store somewhere and keep calling that back. So it depends what you're building, but obviously a good way of doing it typically is yes, you kind of, you're writing, but you're doing things step by step.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're,
so there's like a framework that you follow.
Kind of, yeah. So if you're, you know, if we take it at a basic level of building a form to fill out, right? You might do the fields first, save it, make sure they look all right. Okay, now do the functionality of how they actually fill it in. Great, that looks good. Now submit. So you still, even though it feels like they're just writing, it's a very iterative process normally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can get very lost in it, which is the side of it that I really like, because
how do you, so I remember PlayStation 2.
Yep.
Very random, I know. But when you wanted to save a game, you had a memory card, and then you just go and continue. Like, I know now that we have like Google Drive and whatever, and it auto saves.
Yeah.
But for somebody who was writing code back in the day, how do you just pick up and leave off? What happens if you forget to hit save? Is there like a chance you could just delete all that code?
You could
very
easily.
Does that still happen now, or is it all auto save with the way things are?
For the most part, yeah. Normally, you'll, again, in that iterative process, every time you do it, you have to save it to run. So
okay.
that often happens, but yeah, you can very easily.
So you would never leave a piece of code like half finished.
Typically,
you would
not
finish it, test the function, and then maybe stop. Okay, I don't want to go through like a whole other line of code.
And this is why I think it was maybe me that presented this, or one of my colleagues in one of the company meetings when you and I worked together. There was a period of anyone from the commercial side walking into the tech office
and bothering
and asking
guys.
A question. Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I think we put a cartoon up of someone counting or something and the way the thought process stops and that's why I think a lot of people get very annoyed when people interrupt because yeah, you're very much in this flow, this thought process of, okay, if I do this and then I do that and then I do that, this will fix this or this will work.
So then question, with that in mind, do you like being in the office, or do you find it like, has COVID been a blessing in disguise? Like, working from home allows you to really power down, headphones in without being bothered and be more productive?
I thought it would, but very much the opposite. So I used to, again, when we were working together, I used to take the odd Friday to work from home. Take those days to, as you say, power down and not have distractions.
Yeah.
Which is really great. And then as soon as that's your only thing, it becomes a lot more difficult to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I found that anyway, because that area had become the kind of power on space that when you need it, you use. And when it's always there and you're not always needing to be in that workflow or that state, it completely changes the mindset of it. So I'm now kind of the opposite of that. Of I work a lot better in the office.
Oh, wow. But do people still bother you?
Yes, plenty.
What's the happy medium, I suppose? Work in the office and people, I mean, maybe what you should do, and this is, you know, give me some money for this. Maybe you should have like allocated office hours where outside of, unless the house is burning down, you can come to me like every other hour or for 15 minutes or, you know, just before lunch, once at lunch, once at the end of the day, and I'll be able to help people. Because, and that could help you with flow state.
Yeah, it's a very good idea, yeah. That was one of the things that I used to be very good at.
Sorry, by the way, for bothering you, because I know I did.
Not at all.
Okay, So after we go to the football club, it's a nightmare. 4.5 months. Where do we go to?
Decibel.
That's the next step.
Yeah. So I was looking around in, at this point, anything related to front end, I wanted to be involved in, and obviously Decibel is that. So we obviously collect data off websites. So it was a tech support role, which a lot of we'd been kind of told at university of don't overlook that as a role, because it's often a really, really good way in to places, particularly because the nature of it normally means you're touching so many aspects you might not if you're perhaps a junior developer, because you might, as a junior dev, you'll often get sat on one very specific project and do that, whereas tech support, particularly at Decibel, is
anything and everything can break.
And we have so many clients as well, so you're constantly looking at different things. And I remember going in, the first interview was at 7 a.m. I remember going up to, and you'll know that probably summarizes that place quite well. It was just me, Ben, the CEO, and Tim, the CTO, in a room, and obviously nobody in the office. It was a very weird environment. And I had two interviews. Part of the tech task was implementing on a website I'd built, and I kind of knew when I went in to present the task, I felt very confident because one of the websites I'd done actually broke the session player. It couldn't work with the way I'd built the website, and I had noted how to solve that. So I kind of thought, I can do this job here, right?
That's
a really good thing as well. When going for interviews, of almost finding flaws or problems, particularly if you're in tech, if there's, you know, if you can find an error or something not working on the site, and maybe go in there with an inkling of, look, guys, it could be this, then it's a really good insight into how you're going to then be in that.
Would they expect you to fix it?
Potentially, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well.
It might be, but it could even just be, because the other thing with tech tasks that a lot of people get put off on is, I can't do it. And often the point of the task is not, if you finish it, fantastic, great. Yeah. But actually, it's normally about the process, and you'll get asked to talk through the process itself rather than them marking you on having completed it.
Okay.
Because if you've picked up that code off Google, put it in and fixed it, if I don't understand it and you get grilled on it, you're not going to get the job because you can't answer. Whereas if you've got 60% of it done and the way you've done it is
you follow
elegant
the process,
and really good, you're much more likely to get that role.
So, piece of advice there, don't copy code off Google.
Without understanding.
And focus on the process.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Because the destination, the journey is more important than the destination.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm a broken record. All right, so Decibel, you start in tech support. I know, obviously, from working with you that you move into solutions engineering and senior solutions engineering and like whatever else, because bloody hell, you did everything. How do you make that transition? So you've mentioned that, you know, tech support is a nice way to get into it. Mm. How do we transition across into dedicated?
So I was really lucky and maybe unlucky as well. I was employee number 5, I think.
Oh, bloody hell.
So very, very early days. I remember on day one just being given the laptop, kind of crack on, and my phone ringing, and it was a client asking for help. I've used the tool for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That was very, it was good. It was really good to just have to dive in and do it. And that, I think that's how I've always done things. Mm-hmm. Again, very much learn by doing rather than kind of watching.
So for you, you don't feel overwhelmed if you don't know something?
I did in the early days, you really, did. Really badly, yeah.
Because I know, even me, like, if I don't know something, I love to over-prepare, and if I'm not prepared, I bloody hate it. So you said you did in the early days.
Yeah, and especially, because the role was tech support, but I was doing the implementation, which was the solution engineer role. I was on a lot of sales calls as, you know, the tech guy to answer all the questions.
Yeah.
So I was already doing a bit of everything. But if I went into a meeting, I would be terrified they'd ask me what I didn't know.
Yeah.
And so that really drove me to make sure that not the smartest person in the room, but always be the person that knows the most about what we're doing in the room, which always kind of held me in good stead, and then also gave that confidence when you walk in of, you know, they're probably not going to get something that I don't know.
So it's a question just to people who are on calls with clients. Mm. They might be new to a role, just still familiarizing themselves with the tech. How do you navigate conversations where you're not 100% sure what you're talking about?
If you don't know the answer, you say you don't know it. I think that's always the best way. And particularly now, having gone from working on that side to being the other side, to now working with, you know, companies like Decibel, with you know, Facebook, Google, and you see through it very quickly.
Yeah.
So when you can tell when someone's blagging an answer.
Yeah.
If they don't know it. And that's so much more frustrating to hear than someone just saying, I'll figure that out.
Yeah.
The best thing you can say is just, I will find that out for you. Because getting the right answer, then you have the problem of potentially putting your foot in it as well, of hinting at something else that it's not.
Mm.
And as you do that too many times, your credibility just
or promising goes. Something and not being able to deliver on it. So another question I have with that, obviously working with the clients we did, how did you prioritize? So I know from working at Decibel, if things weren't working, like everything was the top priority.
Yeah.
Everything needed to be fixed now. Mm-hmm. Like you say, you go on calls, you don't know, you've got to follow up. How did you prioritize your workload, and, you know, was it causing high levels of stress? I suppose that's
100%. Yeah, it was. I think I look back on that time with, I romanticize it a bit, but also then remember how tough it was as well, particularly those early days when it was just myself. But we very early on moved to trying to use tickets as much as possible.
Okay,
and we built that whole system to be as easy to find the priority as possible as well.
Okay.
So kind of color coding based on how long it's been open, based on the priority of it. That really helps. I think I'd find as well that keeping a slot after every meeting, even just 5-10 minutes to do the follow-up, really saves, one, it piling up, and two, it's fresh in the memory as well.
Yeah.
You know, you might tell the client one thing, knowing full well what the full solution is, but you're just going to say, you know, here's the bit I'm going to cover.
Yeah.
And while it's there, you're remembering it, and you can just keep whether it's notes or email, whatever, just doing the follow-up straight after really helps it then piling up, I found.
Okay, nice. So, Decibel, we've spoken about it. You've gone from tech support in the early days into solutions engineer. So being an SE, was that more back end than front end now?
It's more forward thinking.
Okay.
So the tech support role is very, something is on fire, put it out. And the solution engineer is, one, you're involved in the sales process a lot more. So you need to, because normally you're then the one doing the work, you can't promise things you can't do.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you, if you sit in it, it's very easy in a sales call to be there and go, yeah, we can do that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then obviously knowing full well you can't, but someone else will pick it up. But if you're the one doing both sides of it, you can't fool yourself like that.
Yeah, of course.
So that was a big change, definitely. And having to have that forward thinking and build a whole process around it as well, because we didn't have it at that point. And at that point, we had more members in the team. So because I guess I was the only one there, it almost became de facto management, right? In that I had to train anyone that came in because I had the knowledge. And just from doing that, it gradually became, well, I'm the one setting the priorities, the workload, etc. And that then spilt into, moving into the SE role and gradually learning to lead a team for the first time, even if kind of unofficially at that point.
So did it ever become official?
Eventually, yes. So by the time I left, I was service delivery lead for EMEA. And that was that. But that was a bit of a weird process even then, because going back to talking about being ready for things, I don't know if you remember this, we had maybe 18 months without a VP. And every other department in the company had one. And it was very much almost like a cursed position. Like, is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? And I'd been on, I think, 3 promotions in 3 years. And at that point, you're very much like, I can do anything, kind of sky's the limit. And you get that bit of arrogance of, no one knows more than me and all of these things. And I was maybe 25, 26 at this point. And thinking about going for this VP role, which is, it's 15, 20 years experience. But that...
What stopped you?
I actually sat and... For the first time ever, probably sat and properly thought about things, and it kind of dawned on me for the first time that as much as the advancing is great, I've got to make sure I'm still learning, because, and that kind of drove me to leave eventually as well, because obviously I knew everything about the platform. We'd built a load of processes in based on just what I felt worked well, and there's no evidence that they were good or bad as well, and so for me, it was, I've reached this level. I think what we're doing is good, but I kind of need someone who's been there and done it to tell me that. And it dawned on Rickett that if I moved into that position, I'd be found out very quickly.
And it
would be, the best thing for my career would be to learn from someone who's been there that I can take that kind of lessons from.
Okay, so that moves us nicely into like your next couple of roles. So the next role, was it more about the position or who you were going to learn from based on what you've just said, or both?
Both. And and I think I hit the point where I had to get out. I think there was nothing really new to learn about the platform. There was nothing really new to learn about processes. And therefore it was, well, other than being comfortable, what am I doing here? What am I actually learning? How am I going to advance? Because there were ample opportunities for advancement in terms of roles, but actually the responsibility wouldn't have changed at all. It's just the title, and that's all well and good, but I think I hit the point where it'd been maybe 5 years of the arguably first proper enterprise role that I'd been in, and I think if I went one more role up, I think at that point your CV becomes not necessarily cursed, but almost you've only ever done it one way. And I think I see that now when hiring sometimes, where you go, I'm not sure how adaptable they're going to be because they've only ever been in this one place. So that was a big drive. Going to learn, the person I was replacing had moved up into the role above at Telium. So obviously there was so much to learn because he'd done that role that whole time. So that was a big draw. Going to do it somewhere else, a slightly bigger company, bigger team, and it was...
And it's a whole new software, right?
Yeah, exactly.
New languages or similar?
A few, because there was a lot of server side stuff there, which was really good to learn, and is actually then I've taken a lot of that with me to the current role.
And I know we don't have a lot of time, but in that role, you mentioned that you did that through COVID, right?
Yes.
How was it navigating that through COVID? Do you feel like you had the support? You mentioned it's a bigger team. Did you keep in regular contact with people? How was it communicating with customers? Was it a strange time?
It was weird. I think I had the benefit from Despel. Obviously, we did a lot of stuff online anyway, right? Mm. Yes, we went to see clients, but most of it was done over Zoom anyway. So that side wasn't too bad. The team side was very strange because I struggled a lot mentally, I think, during that period of just, you know, I think we all did, right? Yeah. We were cooped up. And so I tried to make sure that where possible, that if anyone else was feeling that we were quite open. And so Telium were really, really brilliant in that whole process. They had, you know, Friday drinks online and board games and really tried to keep everyone upbeat. And that translated definitely down into management as well. And I've tried to make sure that was the case and regularly talk to people, regularly make other people talk to other people as well. Mm. So whether it's small little team pod meetings or any of those things, making sure there's a constant bit of communication without overdoing it of that like Zoom fatigue that we all had.
Mm-hmm. And then that takes us nicely into UX Net-a-Porter. what made you transition again? Because obviously you've been at one place 5 years.
Mm.
This place not so long.
Yeah,
sorry for asking a personal question, but no. Yeah.
So for me, it was, I think one of the reasons I gave when saying that I was leaving was just, unfortunately, this will always be the COVID job.
Mm.
You know, it will be the role I associate with being kind of isolated at the same time, even if the two things are completely separate. And it was, I think I'd hit a point mentally where something in life had to change. Mm. And it was, you know, we liked the flat we were in. I liked my marriage. So job was the main thing to do there. So that was, it came a bit out of the blue. I'd looked around a bit at a few roles and I'd made the decision that I wanted to go onto I wanted to be a client rather than being the product. Because
sick of that shit.
Because even with the long-term aim of going back into the product, but having got the know-how of being on the other side. Because I think if whatever position I wanted to end up in, whether that's at a higher management level or consultancy, I need to understand what it's like to be on that other side of using it. And yeah, because we can turn around as a product very easily and go, yeah, look, we'll get to it, we'll solve it. But if you're there and your manager's on your back going, you know, the CEO needs this tomorrow, and you've got to relay a message to support or someone, that's really difficult. So I wanted to make sure I experienced that. And I really enjoyed it. Really like the team I've got.
Do you manage people?
Yes. So we've got a team of nine. So there's nine of us split between London and Italy, which is also really nice to bring, you know, to work with different cultures is really enjoyable. My boss is in Italy as well. So I really get to experience both sides of that.
You get to travel there?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
Milan and Bologna.
Oh, nice. So just a question. Obviously, you know, we're about a similar age, but it sounds like you've been managing people, you know, for a few years now. Has there ever been have you ever felt weird about managing people older than you? Do you manage many people older than you? Mm. I'm assuming that you do.
Yeah.
And how do you navigate that? How do you be authoritative, I suppose?
Mm. I think so. Everyone I managed at Telium is older than me, which I think I was coming off the back of this masterful role at Decibel. There was a level of confidence, I think, that helped me in those initial stages. Yeah. Definitely, I think with it being COVID, that I think that level of authority had to go a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost there had to be a bit more compassion than authority at that point. But I think I've always found that it doesn't really matter unless you show it to matter. Mm. Right? If you do something immature, that's the only way that your age is gonna matter. Because that's me. If you fine, you might not be able to call on the same years of experience as the person you're managing, but that doesn't mean you can't give value to them. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I've always tried to make sure that I do of never, yes, yeah, have authority and make sure that you know, there is awareness that the wrong.
Sorry, maybe authority is the wrong word, but
no.
Yeah, you know what I mean, though. Like,
definitely, yeah.
Getting people to kind of follow, listen to, you know, when you are, I suppose the question I have, because it's going to say, you said delivering value, right? It's making sure people, how do you make sure people receive that value? And then I suppose the other question is, what is that value that you try and give to people when you're managing?
It's taking the different perspectives, right? The whole point of being in a management role is being able to help someone who's potentially siloed and look at it slightly differently. and that's the, but also never trying to be, I think especially if you are younger, never trying to make sure that your word is gospel. I think that's a really big one, to never just disagree with everything for the sake of disagreeing. I think you've got to be open, you've got to be vulnerable, and I think over time that then, like you say, it's about showing value, right? You've got to show them that what you're saying to them is actually worthy of listening to, and actually can help them improve or help them solve the predicament that they're in.
Okay, Tim, this has been an amazing conversation. Just before we wrap up, just to find a couple of questions. Mm. What's the end goal for you? You know, you've done a few roles now. Is it to own your own business? Is it to, you know, you've mentioned your client side now. Is it to go, you know, back to, you know, the company? I don't even know what the word is now. I've lost it. But where do you see yourself in the next 5-10 years?
I think learning and knowing as much as possible, as cheesy an answer as that may sound, I'm definitely very happy where I am at the moment. I think anyone who says they're there for life is kidding themselves. Yeah. Absolutely. At the same time, you should treat the work you do as if you will be there for life.
Of course, it has
longevity. I think the end goal's always simply me been on the consulting side, I think. So that came from a very early day of being at Decibel, where working with so many different clients, yes, there's pressure, there's difficulty with priorities, but having that full world view of how a banking industry does one thing and how retail does it is really insightful for me. And I'd like to think there's a lot of knowledge spread across a lot of different subjects that I can use to give value.
As you've said that, I just said, wrong answer. You're going to be building websites for Vibes and Tribe. You're going to build my app and you're going to help me go global. No, I'm joking. Tim.
Help me in.
No, thank you so much for this. This has been great. Really beneficial. Thank you for being so open, so honest. Just before I let you go, do you want to plug any socials? I don't know if there's any resources for people, aspiring people in tech.
Yeah, I think utilizing that, YouTube, Udemy, you know, Code Academy. My wife works for a company called Multiverse, who do degree level apprenticeships. So you can have a job and do a degree at the same time. They specialize in data and tech, which I think is super useful. They're probably main ones, I think.
Amazing. Guys, if you've made it to the end of the episode, make sure to like, share, comment. Tim, thank you so much. We could have unpacked that for another hour, but I'm getting some looks from the cameraman, so no, but thank you so much, Tim. This has been Vibes and Tribes, over and out.